This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
We also have Joshua Taylor.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
The war in Ukraine is really driving world events and biblical prophecy in a number of phenomenal ways. We're going to cover several of them on today's program. We'll start, though, with an update on the latest in Russia's war on Ukraine. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah.
Yeah, Russia has continued to push toward Kyiv, Ukraine's capital and largest city, this week. The fog of war, of course, remains thick, but from what we can see, it is looking more and more like Russia's highest priority is to encircle Kyiv, capture it, and topple the government. So Russian dictator Vladimir Putin, he's directing more and more of his resources toward that goal. And the citizens of Kyiv are fleeing en masse. Reports yesterday said that more than 1.5 million of Kyiv's people have now fled, which is about half of the city's population. The Trumpet's contact there still has not fled, Mr. Taras Revenets. He has elderly parents and poor health that he alone looks after, and they're in no position to move. But he's been just devastated by everything that's happening and how the world has just kind of abandoned Ukraine to Russia. I spoke with him this morning, and he said, "I'm so heavy-hearted right now. I don't have much to say. All I can think of is that quote by Winston Churchill, 'An appeaser is one who feeds a crocodile, hoping it will eat him last.'" So just a lot of desperation there. But with the Kyiv advance, the Ukrainian forces have been able to repel the Russians so far, or at least slow them. Ukraine's mobile infantry force has had commendable success in especially attacking the logistics of the Russians, just moving around and continuously cutting their supply routes so that they can't get fuel to those gas-guzzling tanks and they can't get food and ammo to the soldiers. So that has slowed the advance into Kyiv. And then there was a particularly effective attack that Ukraine made on a column of Russian tanks on Wednesday. The Russians, for whatever reason, were looking a bit like they did in 1944, rolling tanks in without accompanying infantry. That was, you know, effective in World War II, but now with so many Ukrainian infantry in possession of Javelin missiles, a missile that lets one infantryman easily take out a tank, it's not really an effective strategy. The video footage of the Ukrainians devastating these Russian forces, it's surreal to watch it. So Putin's forces have not yet conquered Kyiv, but they have inflicted some nauseating violence on the city of Kharkiv, and even more so in Mariupol. Mariupol is a port city in southeast Ukraine, and the Russians this week seem to almost be taking some of their frustrations about failing to take Kyiv, taking those out on Mariupol. The Russians hit Mariupol with devastating airstrikes, largely on civilian areas. The people there have been under bombardment for days now, and they've been without food, water, or electricity for about a week. Russia also hit a maternity ward there yesterday. It was said to be an indirect hit, but reports still say that at least three people were killed, including a six-year-old girl. The day before, the Russians struck a children's hospital, which is said to have wounded 17 people. So just tragic beyond words to see this happening. But here again, the Ukrainian forces are punching above their weight in Mariupol. Over the past 48 hours, they've destroyed 4 Russian Su-25 jets and 2 Russian helicopters, not at all insignificant gains there. But if we take a step back here, in a war like this, there are two factors that can really give the invading force great power, and that's surprise and speed. So Russia at this point has lost both of those, if it ever even had them. So now all that's left is overwhelming force ruthlessly applied. We got a little glimpse of that this week in Kharkiv and even more so in Mariupol. And I think we should expect to see more of that in the days and weeks ahead in Kyiv and other Ukrainian cities.
The Western media really seem to be playing up every shred of hope that Ukraine is going to be able to prevent Russia from overtaking them. But there is really a lot of evidence that that Russia and that Vladimir Putin have no intention of backing down, and we could see continued escalation of exactly the kind of sickening violence that you're describing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that's why we should expect to see more of that just overwhelming force. Geopolitical Futures Chairman George Friedman spoke about this in an interview yesterday. And he said, quote, "I would expect that Putin would now decide to bring in massive force to basically crush any opposition and intimidate the citizens." You know, so it's exciting in a way to see Ukrainian gains and to see them push back. But for each one of those, we have to realize that Russia only has a toe in the water at this point. Mm-hmm. They've engaged very few of their forces. And I hope Friedman and others are wrong about that. But I think if you really look at Putin, look at everything he's put on the line, weigh all those factors, you see that it does look like it's going to get a lot worse.
Richard, you were talking about this on the Trumpet Daily the other day, quoting an American Russian expat who has quite a lot of friends over in Russia, and just the disparity between what he's hearing reported in Western media and then what he's hearing from the people on the ground there, and even kind of a overemphasis in Western media on the disaffection that Russians have for Vladimir Putin, when the reality is that Putin is actually, he has quite a lot of the support of the Russians behind him.
He does. And I think, you know, you look at Russian, you look at, you know, what he says as a powerful warning there. I think there's a very powerful warning in just in Russian history as well, where again and again, you have these Russian leaders come along that people thought were wonderful reformers who would change Russia into a kind of liberal democracy, and then they end up, once they get resistance, cracking down brutally. I mean, Russia always has a certain amount of resistance to even its strongest leaders, and they've tended to respond by cracking down. I mean, Ivan the Terrible at first looked like he would be a reformer. You had people like Catherine the Great that were carrying on a correspondence with Voltaire and seemed like she was going to bring Western ideals into Russia. And all of these different leaders, again and again, they have uprisings, they have rebellions, and you have brutal, brutal crackdowns. People thought Vladimir Putin could be a similar kind of reformer, helping to bring democracy to Russia after the kind of the chaos of the post-Cold War world. And you look at Russia's history, and people have been saying this for years, but, you know, we kind of see kind of the Ivan the Terrible switch. The same switch that you saw with Peter the Great, or some of these Russian leaders that may have started out with some fairly liberal ideals as they encounter these protests and just crack down. And that's what this one of the things this Russian expat was saying is, look, I know the history. I know what went on with Stalin. I remember my parents being terrified when somebody would criticize the government around the dinner table. And I'm seeing the same thing happen again. Are we going to get gulags in Russia? It's changing Russia's foreign policy, but the last two or three weeks have changed Russia internally as well.
Yeah, you know, these comparisons that Gerald Fleury has made between Putin and Stalin, I think a lot of people could have viewed those and criticized those as being maybe exaggeration. It is remarkable to see these developments that really are pushing Russia much more overtly in that direction that he was describing. So Jeremiah, you've written a bit about just how Putin doesn't have the luxury of backing down because of how much he has invested in this offensive in Ukraine. Maybe you could just give us a bit of an overview of what we might expect with Bible prophecy as our guide.
Yeah, sure. Well, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote about, you know, this unconscionable war on Ukraine just the day after it broke out. And I think he gave us an excellent roadmap to look at for the prophetic angle there. He pointed out that this is something, as you said a moment ago, that he's actually been specifically warning about for many years now. One part of his article says, quote, I have been warning for more than two decades that Vladimir Putin would be responsible for violent conquests and that he would set in motion some astonishing and historic events. This understanding comes from studying the Bible and believing God, and he has much to say about Russia and Vladimir Putin. End quote. And then from there, Mr. Fleury takes a look, especially at Ezekiel 38, and he explains how this chapter in verse 1 and 2 actually refers specifically to one individual that Mr. Fleury has said he is certain is Vladimir Putin. In the King James Version, this passage talks about a chief prince. And Mr. Fleury writes, "I strongly believe this chief prince is Vladimir Putin. The alarming and sobering scenes coming out of Ukraine today dramatically prove that this understanding is right. Bible prophecy is being fulfilled this very moment in Ukraine." So, you know, there's a lot to unpack there, many details, and I think it would be difficult for a listener to, you know, to take it all in just hearing it explained in kind of a brief way. So I would recommend that any listener who is concerned about events right now with Russia and Ukraine and wants to understand it in this big picture context, I would recommend looking that article up and spending some time just carefully reading it with your Bible. Once again, that's called Bible Prophecy Comes Alive in Ukraine.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. The world really has been making a big to-do about this invasion from Russia, but their response has not been enough to really stop what Russia is doing. In fact, there's evidence that Germany has been deliberately undermining efforts to keep Russia in check. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, we already spoke of kind of this difference between rhetoric from the media and reality. And I think you see this certainly in this idea of sanctions against Russia. And you kind of get the impression reading some Western newspapers that Russia was completely falling apart, that Vladimir Putin could be unseated within coming days as people revolt against these crippling sanctions. And the reality is very different. And a lot of that reality, the different reality, gets back to Germany. You know, Germany, they abruptly reversed course on their military position. They announced, you know, this massive influx of military spending, and at the same time they said they were changing course when it comes to their relationship with Ukraine. And this has led to a whole lot of questions about their relationship with Russia, something that we've talked a whole lot about. You know, we talked a lot December, January, the run-up to this Ukrainian invasion, about how Russia was empowering Germany. 2 weeks ago you get this massive announcement, and you know, was that Germany switching? Was Germany's relationship changing with Russia? Well, you know, this week we've gotten a very clear look at the truth, and that's not the case at all. Germany changed its public face, but fundamentally they're still working alongside Russia. You know, we're coming under a lot of pressure because of their ties to Russia. There was a real risk that all of Europe could have abandoned Germany because of their cozying up to Putin like this, you know, forever losing the chance of leading Poland and a lot of Eastern Europe that were very concerned. So Germany kind of put in place enough changes to remain inside the kind of the Western club. They sent some weapons to Ukraine. They allowed other countries to send weapons to Ukraine, things they had not done in the past. But since then, they've really been working hard to undermine sanctions on Russia from within. So Joshua on Wednesday's show, he kind of talked about the way that Germany was refusing to stop buying its oil and gas from Russia and the big difference that made. The Ukraine's ambassador to Germany, he came out, he called that decision a knife in the back of Ukraine. And then starting last night, going into today, EU leaders are meeting in Versailles, and it looks like Germany has successfully blocked the EU from cutting itself off from Russian oil. So European money, German money, it's going to keep flowing to Putin. It's going to keep enabling Putin to buy those bombs that are raining down on the citizens of Mariupol and other Ukrainian cities. Sanctioning Russian oil, Russian gas, that would hurt Russia to the tune of $235 billion a year. It would be a massive, massive hurt. And The Telegraph says that, you know, this amount of money that they're getting may be enough to pay for the Russian oil effort. I mean, if you just have, say, the United States cutting off Russian oil and Britain, but not Europe, you could just see Europe buying more oil and gas from Russia at higher prices. And the net result is just sending more money to Putin because it's just sent the price up. You kind of need everyone involved to cut this off for it to be successful. The Telegraph's Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, he describes the EU's policy as a smacking of business as usual. that they'd come short of really hurting the Kremlin. The EU's policy, the EU have said they're going to cut imports of oil and gas from Russia by 2/3 by the end of the year, but they've not said how. So it just seems kind of a vague commitment that's not going anywhere. And you're seeing this throughout everything. SWIFT. We've heard so much about SWIFT in the last 2 weeks, and that Europe has finally agreed to cut Russia off from SWIFT, and that Russians are starving and running out of money. And again, you go beyond the headlines and the rhetoric from Western leaders, the reality is very, very different. Europe insisted throughout the run-up to this crisis, Russia will not be cut off from SWIFT. Then as the pressure came on Germany, it was kind of like, okay, well, we'll cut 70% off of Russian gas banks from SWIFT. The final result, once it was all negotiated, was just 30%. 30% of Russian banks cut off from SWIFT. Radically different from the total cutoff from SWIFT kind of that was promised and the impression that you're getting from the media. And everyone all around this, they see that it is Germany that is behind this, that Germany is the one stopping this from moving forwards. So in an area after area, you've had Germany, okay, do enough so that they maintain, that they stay inside the Western camp, and then from inside, they've stopped so many of these sanctions from being as bad as they could have been.
So a couple of things come to mind in looking at this. One is this really does underscore what Gerald Ford has been saying for some time, that there is some kind of a deal that Germany and Russia have worked out. And it seems like this is playing out exactly how you would expect if there were some kind of Molotov-Ribbentrop, a modern era deal between these two, that Germany, it's trying to present a face that it is going along with everything that the West is trying to do to slow Russia down. But really, it's putting the brakes on it because there is an alliance there. And the other thing is, when you view what we talked about last week with Germany using this as a catalyst to rearm, to boost its military spending to unprecedented levels, it really smacks of there's something very false and hypocritical about what it's doing, that it's using this. It's basically just as a pretext. That it's almost like it intended to use this all along, that it's actually, it's telling Ukraine you need to surrender to Russia, and it's still kind of playing both sides of the fence by saying, well, we need to defend ourselves against Russia at the same time.
Yeah, it is a really interesting response. Ambrose Evans Pritchard, I thought he had some really good insight, where he said some seem more interested in using this, quote, beneficial crisis as a federalizing catalyst, a chance to force the pace towards EU fiscal and defense union, whether or not these architectural ambitions have any relevance to the slaughter before the world's eyes. And that's a perfect summary of what's going on in both Europe and Germany, where they can use this crisis to increase the German military or Europe's push towards military. They're going full steam ahead. But when it comes to taking measures that would actually help Ukraine, well, no, then it's just rhetoric, and then it just evaporates very quickly. They're using this crisis as an opportunity. And even it was Libération, this big French news outlet. They had an article a couple of days ago going back to the same tradition that Europe always has of moving forwards in crisis. And the quote from I think it was Monet talking about how Europe will be forged in crisis and be the sum of the solutions adopted to those crises. They're openly saying, this is another crisis that will allow us to unify and come together. That doesn't help Ukraine. And in fact, European leaders, when they got together in Versailles last night, they very clearly rejected EU membership for Ukraine. Ukraine asked to be fast-tracked. One, the Dutch prime minister said, that's not possible. Ukrainian membership is going to take years if it happens at all. Mm-hmm. So you very clearly see that nature of, we'll use this in ways that benefit us, but we're not going to actually help Ukraine. And this, like you said, that's something that Mr. Fleury has talked about for years. He wrote, history shows that in between wars, Germany and Russia often work together Most infamously, just before World War II, the two made a deal in which Adolf Hitler's Germany basically said to Stalin's Russia, stay out of it, Russia, and we'll take over Europe. Then the two of us can split up Poland and other countries between themselves. And that, well, that World War II deal, you know, there was a precursor to that that was signed in the 1920s that had secret clauses and these two working together without them publicly agreeing that they were working together. Otto von Bismarck had a similar treaty with Russia, a reinsurance treaty, where it was working with Russia and it was keeping this completely secret from Austria, one of its closest allies. You know, Germany has repeatedly had these secret deals, not just deals with Russia, secret deals with Russia. It is certainly not beyond the realms of possibility. And I think you look at the evidence and it's almost certain they have this kind of a deal with Russia. And then, like Mr. Flurry does in his article, he has Germany and Russia's secret war against America, for example. You look at the prophetic reality that tells us that Germany really wants to bring down the United States. They're seething with resentment against the United States, as Jeremiah 1 talks about. We can quite clearly see Vladimir Putin makes no secret of seething with resentment against the United States. You know, these kind of deals that you see, they expose that resentment within Germany. They expose that Germany here is working against America. And what it exposes is a fulfilled prophecy going back decades, with Mr. Armstrong talking about how Germany would play this role of working to bring down America. You know, that's what we're seeing playing out in our headlines now, if we look a little beyond those headlines.
Yeah, in quite a dramatic and extraordinary way. You mentioned Josue Michel's article that's up on thetrumpet.com right now. Ukrainian ambassador warns of Germany's betrayal is the title of that. You also mentioned Germany and Russia's secret war against America. We'll link to both of those articles in the show notes for today's program. I'd also like to put a plug in for Richard's Trumpet Daily Show on Ukraine. Was that yesterday, Richard, or maybe that was Wednesday? Yeah, Wednesday's show, talking about how events in Ukraine are really supercharging several prophecies of the Bible, an outstanding program with an excellent overview of many of the ripple effects that we're seeing from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We'll also link to that, and I would really encourage you to take a listen. Thank you very much for that, Richard. We move now to a very interesting story about some sensitive research labs in Ukraine. American officials are concerned that Russia's military could reach these and use them for their own purposes. What is in these labs and why the concern? To learn some answers, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, rumors about biological research labs in Ukraine have been circulating for some time now. And it's hard to tell, or has been hard to tell till just recently, what's been true and what's been not. Some of the rumors have been pretty out there about how Putin's invasion of Ukraine is really like a covert operation to stop the CIA from spreading a pandemic around the world. And so for reasons like that, a lot of this information has been dismissed until just this Tuesday, when at a Senate hearing, the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Victoria Nuland, came out and she said Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are quite concerned about Russian troops, Russian forces seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how we can prevent any of these research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces should they approach. And so that's confirmation that there are biological research facilities in Ukraine. There is cooperation between the Ukrainian government and the U.S. government concerning these research facilities, and confirmation that whatever they're doing, it's something that we don't want the Russians to get their hands on. So they're not doing like trying to cure childhood diseases or some other sort of charity work that they're afraid Putin's gonna take over and save the babies. And
well, it is interesting, I guess, the way that this is being reported. They're saying the reason they're concerned is that the Russians could use this as the basis of disinformation. It's like they're talking as if everything that we're doing there is completely above board, but that Russia could lie about it and make it sound like we're doing something nefarious.
Right. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists really made that point this week, where they're saying that, like I said, already there are political figures in Russia saying things like, well, Putin's going to take over these labs and then open them up to the world so journalists can come in and show the world what America's doing. One former American police officer who's claimed political asylum in Russia, John Mark Dugan, has put at least 5 videos on YouTube saying that the U.S. is actually doing bioweapons research in these laboratories. And the Russian Defense Ministry itself actually came out this week and said that they have evidence that America is doing gain-of-function research on bat coronaviruses in a bioresearch lab in Odessa. And so basically trying to link these labs to even the gain-of-function research that started the coronavirus pandemic, like the type of stuff that was going on in Wuhan. Now, the timing of all this is interesting, is that the National Pulse has actually done investigation into this, where they found a deleted web article. It was archived on the internet, but a deleted web article highlighting the fact that bioweapons research facility in Odessa was actually built as part of a deal that Barack Obama brokered in 2005. I wrote earlier this week about how when Obama was a senator, he went to Ukraine along with Senator Richard Lugar to basically take $48 million in U.S. taxpayer funds to destroy Soviet-era weaponry. And so Obama's really responsible for disarming a lot of the Ukrainian weapons in Donbass. Well, apparently, on that same trip, Obama and Lugar, when they were meeting with the Ukrainian president, they negotiated a deal to build a bioweapons research facility in Odessa in an effort to study and prevent the bird flu. And so Obama was been involved with building this Odessa lab from 2005, from the beginning, and has been involved in biological research concerning like bird flu since then. And so that's really all I know for sure is that Victoria Nuland says there are labs in Ukraine. She says that we're concerned that Russia's going to get what's in them, that Russia's saying that those labs are doing research on coronavirus, gain-of-function bioweapons research on coronavirus. And now they've uncovered archived web articles showing that it was Barack Obama who approved the building of at least the Odessa lab in 2005 to look at bird flu. And so you're looking at a confluence of a bunch of factors here where you're, one, I mean, the most big thing is if they are really doing bioweapons research, then Newland's right. It would be very concerning if the Russians got their hands on that. But also, two, is that given some of the other revelations about Obama and Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins' role in funding the Wuhan China lab that started the coronavirus pandemic, the fact that he also approved this Odessa lab shows that they may be doing that America may actually be doing some things there that are not something they want well known.
I'm thinking of Gerald Fleury's article in the newest Trumpet print edition, "Was the Coronavirus Crisis Engineered?" At this point, this is a chapter in the book that he is writing about Barack Obama, and kind of connecting the dots and showing just how there is evidence showing that there was deliberate intent to produce exactly this kind of effect, that they would be able to use this to their advantage, as we've seen in so many ways, politically, economically, to fulfill their designs to bring America down. So it's kind of impossible to look at this story in Ukraine without thinking about this larger picture that has been uncovered if you connect some of these dots that have been uncovered over the last couple of years.
Right. I definitely don't think those who are saying that Putin invaded Ukraine in the first place to defend the world from Obama's bioweapons research are correct. Putin has many other reasons why he's invading Ukraine. But given that article you just mentioned from our editor-in-chief about the connections between the Obama administration and the Wuhan lab, I also think it's pretty safe to say that whatever Obama started doing in Odessa in 2005 is probably not very nice things. And the fact that Victoria Nuland is concerned that the Russians are going to conquer that city and either expose those things to the world or take whatever gain of function bioweapons research being done there for themselves is definitely something we should be really concerned about. I mean, yeah, you're looking at like book of Revelation, four horsemen of apocalypse. The fourth one is like disease epidemics and pestilence. And between this bird flu research in Odessa and these bat research in Wuhan, you do just have to wonder is like how much of these prophesied plagues are going to be something that mankind has kind of brought on themselves with this type of genetic research that they're doing in labs around the world, because they don't want to do it in America for some reason, because otherwise the Senate might find out about it. But
Well, we'll link to that article from Gerald Fleury, as well as your article, Flashback, Obama Disarms Ukraine. You referred to that there in that report. We thank you for that, Andrew. The war in Ukraine has sent gas prices soaring, and the Biden administration is trying to mitigate the damage by encouraging other oil exporting countries to increase their production. He's not having much success, though. For this, we'll turn to Joshua Taylor.
Yeah, with energy prices skyrocketing and the gas prices on track to hit record numbers because of Joe Biden's attack on America's oil industry, he is desperately seeking help from the Middle East's two biggest oil nations. And as you said, they're having none of it. According to the Wall Street Journal, leaders of both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have both declined requests to arrange phone calls with Joe Biden. And to add insult to injury, after snubbing Joe Biden with this, both of these nations took calls from both President Vladimir Putin and President Zelensky. So the relationship is being shown for how damaged and how precarious it is. And really, you can't blame Saudi Arabia for this kind of conduct and for not wanting to help Joe Biden, because there is a lot of bad blood between Joe Biden and Saudi Arabia that go back all the way to Obama's time in office. Some examples of that were in the 2020 elections. Joe Biden said that Saudi Arabia should be treated as a pariah state and that they had very little social redeeming value in the present government in Saudi Arabia. So that's pretty insulting if you're the prince of Saudi Arabia right now. And then Joe Biden also, after he became president, removed the Houthis terrorist designation. And this is the group that's regularly launching drones and missiles at Saudi Arabia. And on top of that, he's made Saudi Arabia even more vulnerable by removing United States air defense batteries from Saudi Arabia. And just to add even more to the fire, Saudi Arabia and the UAE are none too pleased at Joe Biden's efforts to revive the disastrous Iran nuclear deal. And again, to pour even further fuel on this already huge fire, on Monday, Jen Psaki said Joe Biden still stands by his view that Saudi Arabia should be treated as a pariah state and that the leaderships had little redeeming social value. So he's trying to woo these countries, and at the same time is still willing to throw more attacks their way. It's really just a contradictory, confusing state in that regards. And in response to Joe Biden, the Atlantic magazine asked Prince Mohammed last week if he felt misunderstood by Joe Biden. And the prince replied, "Simply, I do not care. It's up to him to think about the interests of America."
That's pretty rough. Pretty rough. And as you said, it's quite a dramatic illustration of just how far America's prestige has fallen, the American influence in the Middle East and its ability to affect any kind of to take advantage of these alliances for its own interests, and to looking at it from Saudi Arabia's standpoint, the fact that it has been so pro-Iranian in particular just seems like a real black mark on America's face. Saudi Arabia, it has no interest in helping the United States whatsoever.
Absolutely. As our readers and listeners know, that Iran and Saudi Arabia are the two big power blocks, Arab-wise, in the Middle East. So they're always butting heads and at a war with each other, even in a Cold War kind of state. So seeing the United States attacking what used to be one of our better allies in that region to support and prop up one of our worst, it's definitely left a sour taste in the mouth of a lot of the Gulf states, not just Saudi Arabia. And this is one of the clearest signs that we've seen so far, that the United States' prestige and influence as a superpower, as well as its influence in the Middle East, is well and truly dead. If our readers would like and listeners would like to learn more, I would suggest that you go on to the Trumpet website and look and see Mr. Fleury's article, "This Isn't Incompetence, This Is Treason," in regards to America's conduct in the Middle East recently, and the book, America Under Attack.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Josh. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, more prophetically significant effects of the war in Ukraine, including Europe looking for gas supplies in the Middle East and North Africa, Japan making its foreign policy more assertive, and food prices going up all around the world. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We talked about how the United States is trying to find other sources of gas these days. The same is happening in Europe, which is cutting some of its gas links with Russia. Where will it go to fill the energy gap? For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, as we talked about in the first half, Europe is not maybe cutting off oil and gas as much as quickly as it could, but it is still certainly moving away from Russia in the long term. And so what you've seen over the last week is EU officials scurrying around the Middle East trying to shore up some of these other supplies. And the long-term result of this is going to bring Europe much more now into the Middle East. They're already in the Middle East. It's already an important energy supplier, but it's going to take on much more importance. They're looking at increasing the amount of, or dramatically increasing potentially, the amount of natural gas that they're getting through Algeria. In the long run, they're talking about extending these pipelines throughout North Africa, even going down from Algeria to Nigeria and other countries in a pretty substantial pipeline project. They've been looking at getting liquefied natural gas from Qatar, looking at getting more oil from these areas, potentially looking at getting more energy from Egypt. So, you know, a lot of involvement. But this means that suddenly the security of these countries becomes even more important for Europe. And especially if you start building massive gas pipelines all across North Africa, from Nigeria to Algeria, in an area that actually has quite a few problems with terrorists at the moment, then that means you're taking on significant obligations in terms of bringing stability, making sure that militant groups are not attacking your pipelines. So that you can very clearly see how this can quickly draw Europe into this whole region, having to build new infrastructure and then defend this infrastructure to find alternatives to what they had been getting from Russia.
European involvement in the Middle East and North Africa is a very prophetically sensitive area. And maybe you could just give us an overview of what we're really looking for from a prophetic perspective in Europe's presence in that part of the world.
So I think it was all the way back in 2014, Mr. Fleury had an article, "Watch Algeria." And he said, "North Africa is turning into a battleground with enormously important prophetic implications." And he talked about how Iranian-backed terrorists were spreading throughout the region. You know, we've certainly seen Libya just fall into complete chaos over the last 10 years or so. But he also writes, "Iran isn't the only one interested in Africa. Germany is making strong inroads as well. both of these powers are racing to get as much control of North Africa as they can. They will inevitably clash with each other. And since he wrote that, we've seen much more significant European involvement in Mali, in the Central African Republic. They have already kind of been racing to get control in this area, like he said. But if Europe is now getting an even more substantial portion of their energy needs from here and they can't fall back on Russia, then that race just heats up. They're going to have to run even harder. And then at the same time, you've got the potential of a new Iran deal coming along, empowering Iran, allowing Iran to kind of race even harder as well. You can see this confrontation all across the Middle East and North Africa really heating up quite dramatically. And the Bible prophesies very directly of a clash here. It's in Daniel chapter 11, but Daniel 11 and verse 40 makes clear that it's talking about a clash that happens at the time of the end, and it happens between a king of the north and a king of the south. And we have a whole booklet, The King of the South, that gives you more evidence as to who these powers are. But really, this is a European-backed or a united Europe under Germany, the king of the north, facing off against radical Islam led by Iran. And it talks about Europe or Iran pushing at the king of the north, pushing at Europe in that book. Mr. Flurry says, well, you know, fundamentally, this push is going to revolve around Jerusalem, an important city for both of these power blocks, but that oil and gas could form a very important part of that push as well, that Europe could, or that Iran could really hurt Europe and help draw a European response by attacking Europe's oil and gas. And if Europe's no longer or getting less oil and gas from Russia and turning to the Middle East for that, the potential for Iran to push and to hurt Europe is only going to increase quite dramatically. So you can see the events now pushing Europe to get more involved in the Middle East, really bringing that clash that much sooner.
Watch Algeria is the title of that article from Gerald Flurry. We'll link to in the show notes. We thank you very much for bringing that to us, Richard. We're going to look now at the war, how the war in Ukraine is affecting another part of the world we might not think of, Japan. This Asian nation is actually using the events to make their foreign policy more assertive. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, we've spoken quite a bit in recent weeks about how Russia's invasion of Ukraine has changed Germany. You know, how it's making Germany frightened of Russia. It's also making Germany lose confidence in the U.S. as having an adequate military umbrella over Germany. We've discussed how all this is causing the Germans to take concrete steps to build up their own military power, and that is a major development. And it looks like a very similar scenario could be happening with Germany's old World War II ally, Japan. The Japanese have had a history since World War II that does parallel Germany's in some key ways. They were both defeated by the U.S. and other allies. They both ended up being stripped of their military power to a large degree, especially in the immediate aftermath of the war. And like Germany, Japan then became a U.S. ally and kind of outsourced its security to America. You know, the Americans basically said, don't worry about having a strong military because you're our ally. If anything happens, we've got your back. You can be largely pacifistic and you don't have to worry about it because we're the most powerful military in the world and we'll jump in if anything goes awry. So that security promise from America has kept Japan from fully arming over the years, at least in the more overt ways, because the Japanese felt like they could trust the U.S. But now, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine and all that led up to that, we're seeing the Japanese start to seriously rethink things, just as the Germans have been doing. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida was asked about the invasion this week, and he said it shows, quote, that Japan needs to implement a fundamental upgrade of its defense capabilities. And then Akisha Shoizaki, a member of Kishida's ruling party, he went into even a little more detail about this. He said Russia's invasion and the failure of anyone to stop it is, quote, a big awakening that there are limitations to what diplomacy can do, limitations to what economic sanctions can do. And then he said, Japan needs to be filling in the details of what we may not fully anticipate or may have overlooked in our preparation. So Japan, you know, even before all this, they'd already been very concerned about China's rise and belligerents. So Japan had been boosting its military spending as a result of that. Japan had also been very concerned about how President Trump had really undermined the U.S.-Japan alliance during his presidency. So the Japanese had been, you know, moving more toward military independence since then. And now, added to those two factors, you have a major invasion of a nuclear power into a nation that is a partner of Japan. So it looks like this could all be leading to a Japan that, very much like Germany, is no longer content to trust the U.S. for security, and that wants to get far more serious about remilitarizing.
Tell us a little bit about why you're viewing this as important from a prophetic perspective.
Sure, yes. Well, Japan's return to militarism, it's a trend that the trumpet watches very closely, and that's partly because of history. You know, history shows that in times of war, Japan can transform into just the most perverse and murderous nation you can imagine. The history of World War II shows that very clearly, and some of Japan's earlier wars do too. So we see that history shows us why these current events in Japan are so alarming. But then, as you said, prophecy also sounds the alarm about this. The Bible says that one of the primary axes in World War III will be a group of Asian nations, which the scriptures call the kings of the East. And if you look at Ezekiel 38, that chapter that we mentioned in the first half, it does give some ancient names that indicate that modern Japan will be a part of that end-time Asian military force. So right now, Japan's return to militarism is happening largely out of fear of Russia and China. But going forward, we should expect the Japanese to actually rally behind Russia and China and to add, you know, Japan's military might to it. So I think when we keep all these scriptures in mind, it really shows us why it's so alarming right now to see Japan talking about a fundamental upgrade to its military capability.
Hmm. Well, we will link to that trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism. We thank you for bringing that to us, Jeremiah. For several reasons, the war in Ukraine is driving up food prices around the world. To learn about why this is, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, inflation here in the United States is hitting record highs due to the gas prices going up due to the war in Ukraine. They just released statistics yesterday, and the year-over-year inflation rate at 7.9% overall, and about 8.6% of that was cost of food going up. And that's pretty tough for a lot of Americans, but the situation is even worse around the world. Between Ukraine and Russia together, they grow about one-third of the world's wheat. So it's one of the major bread baskets of the world. And right now that wheat is not getting out to international markets because the it's loaded on Black Sea ports and shipped to nations across North Africa and Middle East. And due to the war, the ports are closed. So that's led to a global increase in wheat prices by about 40%. 40% for wheat futures. I actually think like cost of bread's gone up by like 50% in a lot of nations, and may just be the beginning, because like right now it's due to the fact that, I mean, the wheat exists. It's just not being loaded onto ships. But also in Ukraine, a lot of farmers, due to fertilizer shortages due to the war or the fact that they're actually have either fled the country or are fighting the Russians, are not planting. And so like agricultural experts in the region think that Ukraine's wheat crop could plummet dramatically to the point where they'll have enough food to feed themselves, but their wheat exports will fall by half, which is terrible news, especially if you live in Egypt or Lebanon or Ethiopia or any of a number of Middle Eastern nations that rely on Ukrainian wheat. Some analysts are even thinking that this could lead to like revolution in Egypt. The last time the Egyptian government subsidizes bread, the last time the Egyptian government did away with those bread subsidies, it triggered the Arab Spring. And they said right now, they said 5 loaves of bread cost about 48 cents in Cairo. But they only cost 32 cents a week ago. So bread prices have gone up 50%, which 48 cents doesn't sound like a lot to an American. But if you're an Egyptian who's on a fixed budget and used to only paying 30 cents for your bread allotment, and now you have to pay 50% more than that, mm-hmm. I mean, that could lead to Arab Spring style riots. There's one of the I have a quote here from an article I have online entitled "Ukraine War Drives Up Food Prices." This is from the CEO of an agricultural exchange trade company, where the CEO says, "Remember, bread riots are what started the Arab Spring. Bread riots are what started the French Revolution. It's a biblical event when you run low on wheat stocks. You won't see a global food shortage. Unfortunately, what you're going to see globally is that billions of people might not be able to afford to buy the food." And so he's saying this in particular reference to Ukraine, that said, okay, so if the wheat prices go up 50% because of the embargo, or the ports being closed down, and then go up more than that due to the fact that the farmers aren't sowing, that's a 50% increase in the price of bread, a 50% increase in the price of noodles, a 50% increase in the price of animal feed, especially like the dairy industry. I mean, dairy is not a grain product, but it comes from cows that eat grain.
Yep.
That goes up as well, which, like I said, in America, it's expected that whatever you spent on food last year, you're probably going to spend $1,000 more this year. Mm. Really inconvenient. But in like Egypt or Ethiopia, I mean, you could see Ethiopia is already in civil war like conditions, but you could definitely see some major civil unrest that Islamic parties will take advantage of. I mean, that's one of the reasons the Muslim Brotherhood was able to come to power briefly after that Arab Spring, is that there were a number of people who were radical Islamists, but there were a lot of moderate people who supported the Muslim Brotherhood temporarily, not because they were radical Islamists, but because the Muslim Brotherhood was giving out free bread. Mm. It took a page from the old Roman emperors and found out that if you want to rule over a nation of very poor people, giving them free bread is a great way to get political support.
Boy, it's remarkable to see this taking place. And Andrew actually has an article on the website, "Ukraine War Drives Up Food Prices," and points to statements that Jesus Christ made about famines in the end time being a sign of the end of the age. And I would encourage you to read that. We'll link to that article in the show notes. And we'll just have to keep watching all of these effects in different countries, and the way that this affects not only geopolitics, but the flow of prophetically significant events as well. Thank you very much, Andrew. We'll finish with a story about an unexpected effort at reconciliation between one of the strongest of strongmen and the state of Israel. For this, we'll go back to Joshua Taylor.
This Wednesday, Israeli President Herzog and his wife traveled to Turkey and met with Turkish President Erdogan in what many are calling a turning point in Israeli-Turkish relations. Turkey is currently experiencing a lot of economic troubles, and at the top of the agenda for the talks was energy concerns for Turkey and drilling and energy, as well as offshore oil ventures in the Mediterranean. Turkey is currently trying to break out of the international isolation that it has put itself in, just with its other Arab neighbors as well, including trying to improve ties with Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, just to name a few. This is the highest level visit by an Israeli to Turkey since 2008, and may mark a major step in repairing the ties between the two nations. Israel and Turkey's relations have been fairly strained and icy since Erdogan came to power in Turkey. The main problems really come down to his support for the Palestinians and support for Hamas. By all accounts, though, the visit and talks between Erdogan and Herzog went very, very well, and to quote President Herzog, were very productive. While nothing yet has been set in stone or agreed to by either side, this meeting really does open the door for further reconciliation between Turkey and Israel, though it's still a little too early to tell where this is going to go. Before leaving Israel for this trip, President Herzog said that rekindling relations with Turkey would not be easy, but were important to both their nations and the entire region. One of the biggest sore spots that's standing in the way right now is for Israel is Erdogan's support of Hamas, which they did discuss. And some sources have said that as part of these warming ties and these talks, Israel may expect Erdogan to expel some of the senior Hamas leaders that are believed to still be in Turkey. As a very interesting side note to all of this, the Istanbul Archaeology Museum has also agreed to return to Israel the ancient Siloam inscription as part of the warming ties. This is a six-line inscription that recounts the construction of the Siloam tunnel, which brings water down from the Pool of Siloam to the City of David. So this is a pretty big deal. Israel's been trying to get this back for a long time. Our long-term time readers and of the Trumpet know that we've been watching Israel's relations with its Arab neighbors for quite a while now. And the main reason for this is in Psalm 83, where we see an anti-Israel alliance of both Arab nations and a German-led Europe. As Mr. Fleury explains in The King of the South, these nations will form a secret pact with the express purpose of betraying Israel. And among these nations listed is Edom, which we know as Turkey today. This is why we are watching Israel's growing relations with its Arab neighbors, because you cannot be betrayed if you don't trust the other party.
Never expected that from Erdogan. That is quite extraordinary to see. He must be in pretty tough shape economically. We thank you for bringing that to us, Josh. For more information about that, we will link to our booklet, The King of the South, in the show notes for the program today. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Josh Taylor, and Richard Palmer. And thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Sun Tzu. Victorious warriors win first in their minds, then go to war. Defeated warriors go to war first and then seek to win. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.